Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Film Class Zeros. We watch old flicks and talk about them as film nerds do. I'm Rich, and with me as always is Alex.
What's Hello, up, dude? Sir. I'm ready to go. We are go for podcast.
Are we go for launch?
Absolutely, sir.
So this week, we're going to talk about Apollo 13, one of my favorites. And I'm going to speak for you here and say it's one of your favorites too.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead and speak for me.
Okay, my name is Alex, and I love Apollo 13, dude.
If that's what you're going to go with, that's fine. I mean, you could have said worse things, but I appreciate the... I'll accept that.
As Apollo 13 being a movie that you like.
Yeah, no, it's definitely up there. It's a movie that is ever-present in my mind. It's a movie that I highly respect, mm-hmm. both on the filmmaking side and, you know, obviously... of the actual events and the people that that are involved. So I thought it would be fun to talk about this one and dive into it. So definitely I've seen this movie before, and I'm sure you've seen it several hundred times. So do you have any previous connection with this, or it's just like a movie that you really like?
I love this movie. I'm a big space nerd, so I think like I'm so fascinated with the concept of man at some point looking at the moon and going, you know what, we're gonna go there. And I really do believe in the altruism of like our space program or any space program that says like, hey, look, like we can be the best of humanity, we can set this goal, we can get up there, and we can further the human experience in that regard. I want to ask you something. You said this movie is ever present in your mind. Now talk to me about that.
Well, I grew up in Houston and in South Florida, so it was really easy for me as a kid to be like a big NASA nerd. And so I'm like you. I'm big into science fiction. I'm big into science facts, you know, the space program, all those wonderful things you said about like improving the human condition through exploration and seeking knowledge. I'm all about that. And so I have a great appreciation for this movie and you know, tangentially also the NASA space program. So this is super accessible for me and a great way of just seeing these things in action, you know. And it's a great movie with a tragedy that it could have been a bigger tragedy, but you know, cooler heads prevailed, you know, with liberal application of math and science saving the day. So it's more exciting than it sounds.
Yeah. Again, that's the way into this movie, you know, like it piggytails off the previous tragedy where unfortunately, I believe astronauts were burned alive. Jim Lovell was originally not supposed to, he was supposed to be on Apollo 14, right?
Right. So the way if I have the facts correct, at this point in NASA history, Jim Lovell was the most traveled astronaut. He had been on two previous missions. I think he orbited the moon once already. And just after the, you know, the Apollo 11 landing, that was such a, you know, huge, tremendous deal. The interests started waning from the public and certain aspects certain politicians were trying to justify spending that much money. So interest and budget concerns started to shrink the program and things started shifting around. So when we joined the movie, it's Apollo 13 being lined up and the Apollo 14 crew being bumped up due to circumstances.
Yeah. So there's already built-in concern because of the tragedy that happened. And this is also based on a book that Jim Lovell co-wrote.
Right.
Which I think this is pretty fascinating. Like I have such respect for astronauts because if you think about it, they are basically the closest we're going to get to superheroes, you know, like the way these guys process information, you have to be a genius to be able to go into space. Number one, I don't know about you, but mathematics are definitely not my strong suit and they never have been.
Yeah, that's the same. And that was the thing that was always like that little hitch in my dreams of being an astronaut as a kid, where it's like, well, I'd never be an astronaut because I'm not really good at math, as if that's the only thing. But that's the one thing that I would sort of, that's the one major obstacle that I would always have in front of me.
Yeah, yeah, like same here, anything, you know, like if, when I was a kid also, like I had dreams and dalliances of being in the Air Force, you know, and like being like some kind of pilot, right? Mm-hmm. But my math scores did not align with those dreams whatsoever. You know, like you really have to be like a genius level mathematician / physicist to get into a rocket and travel 250,000 miles away, you know, like you, and you can see that's like, I think one of the interesting things about this movie is Ron Howard does so much with so little in regards of the sets are all the same, you know, mm-hmm. Nothing is science fiction about how NASA is presented or how the rocket is presented or how the inside of the cockpit is presented. You know, these are like recreated things, and he kept the tension very taut during this like almost 2.5 hour movie where it's dials and switches and you're kind of really into these guys pushing the buttons in the modules, right? And also in mission control.
Yeah, for sure. So this is something that's going to come up a lot, but this movie really blurs the line, at least for me, between the events and it being a movie. And I keep talking about it as if what we were seeing is the actual events, kind of forgetting that is that it's a movie with Tom Hanks and Kevin Bacon, because they do mm-hmm. such a great job and I'm so immersed in it.
Yeah, you kind of forget it's a movie. It's almost like a documentary. And also this is like really Tom Hanks hitting that mid-90s pocket of like absolute bangers of movies that he was in, like 93 Sleepless in Seattle, Philadelphia, same year, 94 Forrest Gump, 95 Apollo 13, and also in 95 Toy Story. So he's like the guy who can't fail, you know, helming this movie that is about a successful failure.
Well, talk to me a little bit more about the actual movie. Like, when did it come out?
So Apollo 13 came out in 1995, directed by Ron Howard, whom I love. You know, you may remember him as TV's Richie Cunningham from Happy Days. And I'm hard pressed to think of another movie at that time that was this much of like a biopic that was done so well.
Yeah, there's a movie. This is a movie that I feel like it's like it's so well produced and holds up so well that it's almost like a time capsule. You know, like it stars, like you mentioned, Tom Hanks, Kevin Bacon, Bill Paxton, Ed Harris, and Gary Sinise in various roles of astronauts and mission control people. And it's they're like frozen in amber in this movie, because this is how, when mm-hmm. I think about these people who are real life people who, you know, and this movie is kind of old at this point. But this is how I remember all of them. And this is like their default image of the people in this movie.
Oh, that's interesting. So when you think of Ed Harris, it's this.
Yeah, like, you know, he was recently in Westworld, and he stars, you know, he's an old grizzled cowboy essentially in this movie. And it takes me a while to like remember that, you know, he's a normal person who is of a certain age, and he doesn't look like how he does in Apollo 13, which is how I always think he looks.
I get that. I have that, but not with this movie. It's for Hanks, it's always Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
I think,
well, and you know, not too far off.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a year before, and that's always like the age of Hanks. But he's like an interesting guy, because, you know, as old as he is now, like he still has that timeless face, you know.
Yeah, you know, he's definitely like aged a bit, you know. But he retains like the same features. I think that I think you're right. He's not like full Paul Rudd, but he's kind of like half Paul Rudd.
Listen, for a 65-year-old guy, like he's doing pretty good.
I know. They're all looking great.
Yeah, they're all looking great. Even Ed Harris, who's you did write that he in your side of the notes that you would have loved him to play Captain America.
Yeah, that was like, I was finishing the movie at like 1 o'clock last night when I was writing the notes. And just like a side note, I'm watching him going like, he'd be an awesome Captain America if they decided to make like the MCU back in 1995.
So take us through it. Do you want to go through start to finish, basically, like break down the movie? We're in the first act right now, so let's hear it.
Right. So the movie starts off where astronaut Jim Lovell and his crew are preparing to embark on Apollo 13, the fifth crewed mission to the moon and the third plan to land on it. Tragedy that happened in the training sequence of Apollo 1, where astronauts were trapped in the capsule, and because the door couldn't release, they lost their lives during an accident. This is ever present in their mind, and the movie immediately shows the Apollo 11 moon landing, you know, that, and it puts the movie in very clear context that the missions are amazing achievements, but they are highly perilous. So this is basically where we're at.
Yeah. And these guys are up to go to the moon. That's the point, you know, like, and this is, again, like, it's fascinating because this movie is such a work of art. You know, Ron Howard really crafts like beautiful imagery, storytelling. The score is awesome. The acting is pretty phenomenal and off the charts. And like, what a crew, legitimately, between Tom Hanks, Kevin Bacon, and Bill Paxton. Their chemistry makes it work. Everybody on the floor of Mission Command, like, their chemistry also makes it work, you know. So like, you kind of get through the easy stuff. They're in space at this point, you know, like, they launch, they really go into how the wives are feeling, you know, which is something I can't even imagine, you know what I mean? Like, what if you're the person you're married to has to climb into a rocket ship and leave?
Yeah, they do a great job of that, and showing that side of things, you know, where the movie could completely focus on the job, but it shows the home life and the toll that this takes on the people surrounding the astronauts. It's not just them, it's their families and all the other people who you know, rely on them and who care about them. So in that regard too, the movie starts off great because it's all the astronauts and their families together watching, you know, the moon landing for the first time. We've grown up hearing about it, but can you imagine seeing that live on TV, just having that impact where it's like the world right now just completely changed?
Yeah, I can't even imagine that. And that also, the interesting about that too, is like, you know, that really didn't happen that much before we were born.
Mm.
You know, I think we're maybe like 12 years out of like people landing on the moon in 1981, right? Like, the moon landing was 69.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. You know, that I always think about that. That's kind of interesting where it's like, oh, that was only like 12 years before we were born, you know, and maybe 14 years before we could have watched it on TV. So that's like kind of fascinating.
Yeah. And that was like before the era of like 24/7 news outlets. Not everyone had a TV in their house. Not everyone had a color TV. All the things that they were watching are like these tiny little, I think they're CRT, like old fashioned TVs that are black and white with mm-hmm. grainy footage being sent from the moon inexplicably to the living rooms, you know, across the world. And while your imagination is filling up the blanks, because we're not looking at it on like a 60 inch, like high def screen in full color and everything, you know, they're watching it very compromised, but it's still just such an impactful thing to see it live.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to see a regular moon landing. You know, like, I want to see it happen again.
Boring old moon landing, you know, a regular one.
I don't care much for the billionaire space programs that are happening.
Yeah.
You know, like, I feel like it's really cool, but I don't know, for me, and maybe you feel the same way, where I think I wish we did it as with like NASA, you know, as opposed to like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, like competing for who the best Lex Luthor is.
Yeah, you know what? I didn't want to. I was forced to think about these things while I was rewatching this movie, and it's kind of a bummer because like we grew up where NASA was still a very like prominent and respectful thing.
I
still think it's something that's highly respectful, but the way things are right now, NASA is not exactly, you know, a priority, and it's a bummer.
Yeah.
And when it comes to people having the money to do these things, it's these weird side projects by people who are just kind of amusing themselves, and you know, the way they're doing it doesn't really benefit anybody in a way that isn't themselves anyway. You know, they're sort of just saying like, well, I'm going to build something and we're going to go to space, And what they're really doing is spending a lot of money to do like a 10 minute, you know, high orbit sort of visit in 10 minutes, and they come back and pat themselves in the back and said, I've been to space and I can check this, you know, tick this box of something that I've done. And to me, it feels disingenuous, and it feels kind of, I don't know. It's a letdown. You know, it's not like I went to space and I did something or I stayed in space. It's sort of like it didn't progress anything. And I don't want to get on a rant on that, but it's kind of a bummer where it's like these guys in the movie talk about, even when they're saying to these senators in the movie, you know, what a shame it would have been if, you know, explorers in the past just stopped exploring after they got what they wanted. You know, like the movie does a really good job conveying that they care about the science and the learning. It's not just like, ooh, we can make a lot of money selling moon rocks. It's like furthering the human condition and furthering human knowledge.
Yeah. And that's, I think I romanticize this stuff the same way you do, where I firmly believe that if the space program wasn't mired in politics and money, we probably would have had a colony on Mars by this point.
I mean, like there's a moon colony would be a wonderful thing to imagine, because you feel like that's sort of like within our wheelhouse, and yeah, and it's like that's the next step. It's like, oh, we got there, well, let's put, you know, like a base there, or like someplace where we visit, or maybe like a semi-permanent thing, or sort of moving that thing along. And it's fine. It's like, well, okay, maybe it's not a, you know, space program isn't a government thing, but more of a public, you know, like a private sector sort of thing. And it's like, all right, cool. But in a way that is useful, not in just sort of like, I'm going to go put on a cowboy hat and me and Bill Shatner are going to go and fist bump in the sky for, you know, for the hell of it. And nothing comes out of it.
That did look pretty cool though.
I mean, there are easier ways to amuse yourself. I don't know. I'm getting off on a whole thing, cause it's not like, well, we're going to do this. And then, you know, like, I think like Virgin Galactic with, I forget that guy's name, but
Branson, Richard Branson.
Yeah, that's the dude. I was gonna say the pickle guy. That's like a different brand. So the he's doing like, well, I'm gonna make a high orbit space plane, but people are gonna be able to buy tickets and fly to places and see space and land and all this other stuff. It's not just like me and a handful of people who gave me like $1 million get to say that they were in space for 10 minutes. Does that make sort of makes a difference to me? It's like at least it's being justified in some sort of way. Am I wrong?
No, I understand that. It's the difference. It's that difference between a Tony Stark and a Lex Luthor, you know, in which Branson seems to be more of the Tony Stark guy. He's like I in many ways I consider Richard Branson like the last adventure, you know, yeah, just because of like all the stuff he's done and the stuff he's done with his money. And then the fact that he can turn around and say like, this is how we can travel quicker, but also have an experience that not everybody gets or maybe even wants. You know, like I know a lot of people who would you want to go into outer space?
Me personally?
Yes,
absolutely. Like I feel like I get what you're saying about Richard Branson, because like, listen, mm-hmm, if I was a billionaire, I'd be doing as much exploring as possible, even if it's sort of retreading, you know, a previous paths of others, you know, like I'd hot air balloon across, you know, a country or a continent or something like that. That's totally fine. And when it comes to certain things like pushing the boundaries further down the line of like some sort of, you know, improving travel or figuring something out, you know, at least he's doing it, like, as you said, where it's like, it's in service of something.
Right, right. And that's completely fascinating. And it's not even far off topic with what we're talking about, you know, because this movie and this time period really lends itself to have like this evolved conversation about space travel. And it just seems like, as evident with this flick, what turned, I think, the space program on its head was, hey, listen, we're investing a lot of money into this. And guess what? Sometimes this goes haywire, you know, much like how much time and money did they spend on this mission alone, you know, and training and preparation. It's not like, you know, it's not like you take a guy and you're like, hey, by the way, you're up, you're going to space tomorrow. You know, like it's very much like you have to plan and train and you need to get funded to do this stuff, you know? So they have a successful launch, right? And even then, Ron Howard does a great job of showing the crowd reactions, the family reactions of, is the rocket going to make it into orbit? You know, because you are a tiny person sitting on top of thousands and thousands of gallons of rocket fuel.
It was a great scene, and the CGI of that really holds up. And especially for a movie of that time. And yeah, everyone's reactions to the whole thing is great. You know, like we touched on the perspective of Marilyn Lovell, who she's the emotional focus of the toll that all the things that Jim does, how that affects the family. Like while she is supportive and excited, you know, she is, it's gotta be really tough to see like your husband put himself on the line like that. And you have to raise a family and it's in the most extreme circumstances. You know, what is more extreme than being sat on a rocket and shot into space with all the preparation in the world and in something that is in a primitive space faring vessel that built by the, like, I think they said it like Armageddon. It's just like built by the lowest bidder, essentially.
Yeah. And yeah.
So it's all sort of amazing that any of this comes together at all.
It is pretty fascinating where it's like, I think comparatively to the hopes and dreams we have in our brains of, like, you know, the Starship Enterprise, stuff like this is very much like tubes held together by duct tape, you know?
It's super analog. And the other thing too, is that like, it's also touching on what you said before about the preparation that goes into it. It's all in reality, it's a surface level. It's very, I want to say, I'm going to use, for lack of a better term, I'm going to say boring. It's not boring, but it's a lot of practice and procedure and getting everything right and doing it over and over and over again, calculating and just making sure that everything goes right. And you're basically going through the numbers. Like we hear them talking about, we need the sequence, and space travel and a lot of commercial flights and regular routine air travel is a lot of just doing procedures over and over again, because you're just going by the book and making sure you do your flight plan exactly. So when they're practicing this, that's what they're practicing, just doing it over and over again. And it's also kind of like when they're in the whenever things are happening, the movie hyper dramatizes things, but in reality, when these situations happen, everyone is so focused on procedures that they're not really overcome with emotion, because they are too dialed in to even take that in. Also, you know, there's like a certain sort of, you know, it's like the quote unquote the right stuff, where you have that sort of fortitude of character where you have to let this stuff slide because you got a job to do.
I do think that is very prevalent in the movie too, you know, like, mm-hmm. I find that very admirable, you know, where, you know, the minute Kevin Bacon took out like this tome of calculations and procedure stuff, I was just like mentally checked out for him. You know what I mean? I was like, oh, I would never be able to get through that book, you know? And I don't have like ADD or ADHD. I don't have a focusing issue, but it's just like, oh, that's a lot, you know? And like you said, when you see Mission Command, it's like these guys are all in it together and they're all geniuses, and they can look at these archaic computer screens and figure out exactly what the problem is. You know, like this is like the dawning of the computer age, you know, and the fact that we use these, they use these computers that were the size of like office buildings to get people to the moon is so fascinating to me. You know, that's like, it's interesting because we have it so good now where it's like we have computers in our pockets, we have giant televisions, we're connected to the entire planet, right? Yet, ironically, there's nothing on the moon for us to go to or enjoy, right? But like this stuff was done essentially with a slingshot, you know, like this is like that technology that we were dealing with like 40 years ago or however long, like 60 years ago.
It's all just like an exercise in just physics and math and science, mm-hmm. and just throwing things that, you know, technologically, especially to us, seem so archaic, you know, like even at the beginning when Jim Lovell is giving a tour to people in one of the construction faculties, and he's saying like, one of these days, you know, we're going to advance to, we'll have a computer that fits in a room, you know, and holds tens of thousands of points of data. You know, it's so funny where it's like they are looking towards the future where a computer is small enough to fit not on a desk, not in like your backpack, but in a room.
In a room.
In a room.
Yeah. So it's so fascinating. And like, you know, again, Ron Howard does such a perfect job of showing us these things, you know, and also when they're in space and they're doing the broadcast, you know, that's where we are in the movie at this point. You know, the launch was a success. Lovell has a camera that they're broadcasting to Earth, unbeknownst to them. The networks drop them. I forgot what the exact quote was, but it was like akin to, you know, you made the, how could you make space travel this boring? And I believe they, you have it in your notes also, all the zero G sequences were filmed in a plane simulating low gravity called the Vomit Comet.
Yeah. So it's really interesting just to imagine that, that they went to that extent of to film these sequences. So for people who might not know, they have part of a astronaut training is getting in basically a stripped out commercial plane that is called the Vomit Comet, essentially because it flies in these parabolic arcs. It just kind of very steeply climbs and then arcs very steeply low. And in that middle part, everyone and everything inside is sort of free falling. So it simulates being in zero G, it's part of training. Some private companies, you can rent out a plane and basically float in the air for a little bit. And it feels like you're floating in space. So the fact that they put it, actors and built sets and had camera crews in this to film in the few seconds that they had in one of these planes, and then flew these parabolic arcs over and over again and just filmed 10, 15 seconds of stuff just to have the most accurate portrayal of zero G possible is just mind blowing to me.
Yeah. Ron Howard in an interview not too long ago was explaining how like everything was bolted down. All the set pieces were bolted down, and the actors, those are like legitimate shots of Bill Paxton, Tom Hanks, and Kevin Bacon floating around the Vomit Comet. And apparently they maintained their composure, but some of the camera guys did not. And those were the guys who were kind of puking all over the place.
This happens with me and my brother when we film stuff, because we'll do some project and I'll be in the car and my brother will be either outside or sitting in shotgun facing the other way while I'm driving a car, like kind of fast for whatever thing that we're filming. And he, you know, he's pretty, he's a tough guy, but you know, when you're looking down a viewfinder in a car that's speeding and you're sitting backwards and it's moving around, you know, you will of course get kind of nauseous. So I can only imagine what these guys are going through in a plane that is like skyrocketing and then diving over and over again.
Yeah, apparently Bill Paxton had like the most fun too out of everybody in this.
I believe it. He looked like he was having fun.
Yeah, exactly. I think those were like genuinely like happy shots of the guy like in this insane contraption that they used, you know. So like we're getting past that part, you know, like the cruise in outer space, and then all of a sudden, boom, right? Explosion rocks the ship. They don't know what's happening, and a lot of their dials start redlining.
Yeah, so this is the part where everything is going as routine as space travel gets, and then, as you said, there's an explosion, everything instrument wise wigs out, and no one knows what's happening. And you could only imagine how this must feel when you are on the frontier of something like this, because this is a completely new scenario. They do all the training, and they've done, you know, 12 other Apollo missions, but something like this has never happened. So you have no perspective. And this is the crew trying to keep a level head and figure out what is happening.
Yeah. This is also like, again, this is stuff that actually happened. And this is a testament to the composure that these guys have, you know, like you can say a lot about, you know, like generational differences. I think these gentlemen were still considered like the greatest generation, right? Mm-hmm. Like if that's falling into that kind of like era where it should be a great philosophy for life. If something goes wrong, just Apollo 13 it. You know, like these guys were on top of it immediately. Nobody turned around and was like, you know, I'm going to need a nap for 20 minutes. I need to process this, you know, like as they fan themselves or clutch their own pearls. You know what I mean? It was like, listen, shit's gone haywire. We need to address this right now. And we have to tell Mission Command what's going on. And then they immediately went into like crisis mode, you know, and Ron Howard, again, such a great job showing that the gravity of the situation.
He did a great job in portraying that, and so did all the actors. And the other thing, too, is that the movie, this is where we're going to see a way where they're talking, they are talking about things in a very jargon-y manner. You know, it's very specific, and they're using a specific, like, NASA language. And it's all flying at the audience very quickly, but we're still on board. We still have an idea of what's happening. And the movie is really good in parts where it breaks down things for the audience who may not be familiar with all these very specific terms, so that you feel like you're watching something very accurate, but you're still following it as a layperson. And I mean, again, that's another testament to just how carefully crafted this movie is made.
Yeah. And you know, we're brought to that conclusion through seeing it through the family's eyes and hearing what the families are hearing over the radio, you know, because it went from a quote unquote, like run of the mill moon landing that was boring the networks to now like, this is a rescue mission. And everybody was kind of just, I can't even imagine how that feels, you know, to not be able to do anything, but to hear a voice over the radio basically tell you that your husband or brother or son is trapped in outer space right now. And there's a very slim chance of them getting home.
It's the worst case scenario times 1,000. It's like lost at sea times 1,000. It's, you know, and then their whole solution is basically following instructions, but everything that they do is like, well, we need a sequence. So people are figuring out how to do things and writing out instructions and then translating those instructions. And then everyone having to go through those lists. So there's no ambiguity. You know, it's like doing like putting together 100,000 IKEA furniture pieces in the span of a couple hours for the sake of your own survival.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was fascinating too. Like, again, like I was very like high tension during this film where, you know, that there's that scene, you know, like how long is it going to take the LEM to work? Right.
Right. So we should probably mention that, like, at this point, they don't know what's happening, but they figured out that they're venting gas. They're having oxygen tanks in the, you know, right now their spacecraft is two parts. It's the part that flies to the service module that flies to the moon, and the lander. And the lander is just sort of like hitched on the back like a trailer. And they basically haul that over to the moon. When they get to the moon, they get in the lander, they land on the moon, part of the lander comes back, they reconnect with the service module, and then they fly home. And so that lander is not meant to fly anything. You know, while this is happening, they figure out very quickly, we need to shut everything down. We're losing power. We're going to climb into this lander, and this is going to be essentially our lifeboat from here on out.
Yeah, and they really need to get into the lander and prep it because they're running out of time. And, you know, that whole scene where Lovell turns to Fred and he's like, Fredo, how long is it going to take to get that lander up and running? And he's like, 3.5 hours if I start right now. And he's like, well, you got like 10 minutes.
You're like 15 minutes. Skip all that stuff. You know, it's crazy. It's like you're driving, like, say you have like a pickup truck and you have like a camper van, like a camper that attached, you know, to the, you know, trailer thing.
Yeah.
And then something catastrophic goes wrong. So while the truck is moving, you have to go into the trailer and hang out there until just to survive. And while the car is still like driving down the highway.
And then somehow get that trailer to help you get to where you're going.
It's like, we need to save gas in the truck. So it's going to coast down the highway for 4 days while we survive in the separate thing that we're hauling, and then climb back in so we can hopefully like start the engine up and then park.
Would you have freaked out at this point already?
I mean, me personally, I'm not an astronaut. I'm not these guys, you know, so I could imagine that I certainly would be really scared. You know, I can't compare myself to people like that, you know, no question. I would definitely be freaked out. What I think is really interesting is that up until this point, the moon landing was still kind of on the table. And then they're like, well, we have to close these valves. But then they're like, well, if we do that, then we can't land on the moon. And I think it's really fascinating that at some point they're still like, oh, my God, this is life threatening catastrophe. But the mission is still on. Until it, you know, like, and then it wasn't immediately like, oh, survival mode. It's like, oh, survival mode, but we're still in space and we still have to go to the moon.
I mean, we could, you know, there's that scene where, you know, this is right after NASA is giving them the directions and instructions of what to do and how they're going to get home, how they're going to have to slingshot around using the orbit of the moon as a slingshot to get them back on the right course to Earth, right? And there's that scene where they're looking out of the windows of the module and it's Bill Paxton and Kevin Bacon just kind of really ruminating about like, yeah, listen, like we're here. I mean, we could land, we could do this. And then Lovell basically swallows all of his emotions at that moment about wanting to land on the moon, right? Because that was his dream, and turns around and goes, gentlemen, what are your intentions? We have to get to work and get home, you know? And that was just like this jarring slap in the face. That was like reality right there. You know, like, stop. We're here. I know we're here. Stop fantasizing about landing. Like, I'd like to get home. And then again, they get right back to work.
Yeah. I mean, you can imagine that astronauts, especially in that era, and particularly guys like Jim Lovell, who, you know, landing on the moon is that the dream, that's the achievement, that's what they're doing all of this for. You know someone like Lovell has orbited the moon, he's done two different space flights, which is, I mean, if we're talking about just like human achievements, that's one of the most rare things that you could possibly, you know, achieve, you know. And he did it twice, and then even fewer people actually landed on the moon, and he wanted to be one of those like handful of people. And you know, that's everything that they were doing at NASA, and he was doing at NASA, was to land on the moon. And I, you know, to say like, I did that. And I mean, I could, of all the things that I personally would love to achieve in my life, I, you know, nothing would compare to something that significant and that amazing. You know, I'm sort of glowing about it right now because I think it's just an amazing achievement. So with that said, could you really blame these guys who are in space, even in a dying vessel, and just sort of intending to, training for years and years to land on the moon, and then kind of having to just drive past it and look at it through the window? Because, you know, as tempting as it would be to even try it, it's like your life is on the line. But I could still see them kind of going like, man, we were so close.
Well, that's just a testament to like how, you know, these guys are made of like sterner stuff. And I, again, it's, I agree with you. It's very gleeful thinking about that, where you're like, yo, you guys are in such dire straits right now and you still want to land on the moon. That's crazy.
Well, at the same time, like, they have the ground crew, which we haven't talked a whole lot, but it's all these people who are back on Earth trying to solve the problem and figuring out all like these sequences. Cause you know, we have these guys who are up there trying to survive, but it's the guys on the ground or being the problem solvers, you know. There are in these rooms where they get together and decide turning around directly isn't an option. They have to use the gravity of the moon to shoot them back. So it's a longer trip, but it's more feasible because we're using physics, we're using gravity. And while we may stretch the limits of oxygen and power, if we turn it around, you know, we don't know what part of the ship works and what isn't damaged. What, you know, it's too risky. So we have to send them the long way because that in some ways is the safest way to do things.
Yeah. And again, the number of calculations that these guys are doing on the ground in Houston is mind blowing.
I mean, they're doing it by hand too. Like a lot of it is like, you know, when there's like the riveting math sequence where Jim is like, hey, I'm trying to put these calculations. I need everyone to check my math. So everyone breaks out the slide rules and they're just by hand and pencils, just sort of checking everyone's arithmetic and going like, yeah, it's good. this is the most analog way of flying through space. It's baffling.
It is baffling. And, you know, math is the universal language. I do think, on a personal note, I do think my brother could have fit right in Mission Command.
Is it the dress code of like short sleeves and neckties?
Well, it's that, and also that he's such a math whiz and physics whiz, you know, because he's a structural engineer, and like all that stuff comes so natural to him that I feel like he could have been in Mission Command at some point, you know.
Maybe maybe he could. I have a lot of friends who would fit in, but basically because they were in ska bands and they would just dress the same. I don't know about none of the math part, but they would sort of blend in the background very easily.
Imagine if NASA's standards have just dropped that low because nobody wants to go into outer space, that they just start hiring dudes who look the part.
You're basically just the brass section of local ska fans going over there and trying to make everything work.
That'd be hysterical. So listen, these guys are trying to get home. They're they're coming back. They are coming back home right now. And now it's a matter of just righting the ship using minimal energy. So now apparently, we're at the point of the movie where it's very bleak. There's a bleak outlook for these guys on this craft. They're in the module. The module is not meant to be used as a rocket ship. All the equipment has to be shut down. So essentially they're going to be freezing on the way back to Earth with nothing on and basically maintaining a single trajectory the entire time.
Right. Well, this is also that remembering that it's a movie, you know, in real life, this is a very bleak and visually sort of dull thing because it's three guys in this, you know, tin can floating through space in the dark that's cold, and they just have to suck it up because it's they just have to endure it because that's what's required. They can't have the heater on, they can't really eat anything because their food is frozen, they can't evacuate their waste in space either, so they're sort of keeping everything on the ship. And then the movie, you know, and Ron Howard does a really good way of showing visually like things being frozen over. There's the great use of, you know, they have the cassette player that they've been using to play music, and at this point it's just even the batteries on that thing are fading, so the music is grinding to a halt, and you hear like brrr. And it's a great way of setting the tone of how everyone feels, because no one's talking, everyone's miserable. Bill Paxton's character is physically ill and sick, and everyone is just sort of at their lowest point, because at this point it's you know, like they said, Sir Isaac Newton's at the wheel, physics are doing the work, we just have to sit, we're just along for the ride at this point.
Yeah for sure. And oh man, even just like talking about it, it's the movie's still fresh in my mind, and it's like it's such a spine-chilling film at times. It's extremely intense, even though you're kind of just staring at three guys being frozen and floating towards Earth. You know, like the movie creates such a sense of dread, and you know they're going to be okay, but you still feel like, uh-oh, what else could go wrong? You know, even after multiple viewings of this movie, I still get that same feeling.
I feel the same way, and I feel like it's a really good balance of showing the dour situation and the low points, and then the action beats are problem solving moments. You know, for instance, when they have plenty of oxygen, but their CO2 is building up because they don't have the right filters, and it's this great sequence of, you know, the one part of the ship has a square filter, and the part that they're in has like a round hole, and the guys on the ground have to figure out how to build a filter that fits with just the stuff that they have on with them on the flight. You know, they can't use any extra thing, and then put that together, write a sequence, get it to those guys, and then those guys have to reenact it and then build a filter with the scrap that's on board. And that again, like, you know what's going to happen, but it's a nail biting sequence where you are fascinated by how anyone is putting anything together with you know, the materials that they have lying around. All this lateral thinking that's being engaged is so engrossing and riveting.
Yeah. And also, you know, like we kind of glossed over like the return of Ken to the fold, who was supposed to be originally with them, but there was a danger of Ken Mattingly, who was supposed to be on the mission, but there was supposed to be, he could have gotten measles and was exposed to measles, and he had to be grounded and replaced by Jack Swigert, played by Kevin Bacon. You know, so there was like a little bit of, I guess, professional animosity or professional bitterness between Mattingly and Lovell, because Lovell had to break the news and make the call to keep him grounded, you know. And in, I guess, poetic justice, he's the one who pretty much gets them home.
Yeah, I think obviously, like, I think the movie like over dramatizes these things, but there is that thing where there was the original team that they've been training, and due to the flight surgeon's orders that you know, Ken Mattingly may have been exposed to the measles, and everyone else was had already had them in their lives, so they were immune. And if he had, you know, broken out during the flight, it would jeopardize everything. So he was grounded, and then Jim Lovell had to make a very difficult call where either we ground the team or you replace him with the backup pilot. And, you know, this is, I want to ask you this. If you were sit in this situation where you were going to the moon, mm-hmm. right? And you had a team and you were all tight, and there's like that bond, but one of you had to make the call to cut one or ground the whole team. How would you face that situation?
I do think the right call would be cut one, you know, because yeah. you're dealing with something that is bigger than you are. You know, it's not like a trip to Vegas. You know, it's, you're going to the moon. And that, I think, again, that all-encompassing striving to bring humanity to its next step of evolution is bigger than whatever you may feel towards the person that you're sitting next to that could be sick, that could jeopardize this mission, you know? And I think at that point, you know, these guys are all professionals. And it seems like, you know, from what we've gathered in the history of space travel, as far as like NASA goes, there's a lot of stop starts, you know, and, mm-hmm. you know, the movie doesn't go into how these guys feel. They kind of touch on a little bit, like Ken goes home, gets kind of drunk and goes to sleep, you know, and yeah. then he's roused to go help them. And, you know, at no point is he like, you know what, if these guys, they cut me from the team, he's like, well, what could I do? And he immediately gets up, gets ready, and starts making calculations with these guys, you know, and like starts simulating, you know, starts simulating on the grounds with the exact same materials that they're supposedly having up in outer space, you know? So like, I think it's like that weight definitely creates some kind of understanding. How about you?
I think you put it in a very good perspective, where you said it's something bigger than yourself, because, you know, you could be like, oh, team solidarity, all of us are none, but that's not in service to anything. You know, like you grounded the team because you want to support one of the members of the team. And it's like, great. Well, you've just for this person's feelings and for your own pride, you've brought this whole thing to a halt, and then other people have to go. So what did that really accomplish? And these are a group of professionals. And while everyone, you know, people are human and they have feelings, the crew and Mattingly, though very upset, completely understands that this is the right call. He may not express that, but, you know, it's you have the feeling that he knows that this is the right thing to do. Obviously, like fatefully, as the movie portrays, that this is something that, you know, works out in the sense that like he's the one on the ground that has a huge hand in bringing them back home. So like that's, you know, a kind of like a weird like happy accident, I guess. But yeah, I think you said it the best, where it's like it's not about your feelings, it's about getting the job done. And And this is the call. I don't think it would be easy, but I think that that's a good way of rationalizing this decision.
Yeah. As also, you know, they're coming back, they're on their way back. And as Jim Lovell's mother put it so succinctly, if they could get a washing machine to fly, my Jimmy could land it.
That's a great part of the movie too, because we talk about like Marilyn Lovell and her family trying to like keep it together and have this composure. You know, and they have this occasionally they cut to Jim Lovell's mother. She's an elderly woman, and you know, she is seemingly you know, she's an older lady, and they want to protect her and make sure she's okay. And when they break the news that there was an accident, they're trying to like be very gentle about like, hey, there was a thing, but Jimmy's fine and all this other stuff. They're holding back their own anxiety for and fear while they're delivering this. And but the kids can't keep it together. They're very upset. And, you know, Jim Lovell's mother, let's call her grandma, kind of looks at these kids saying, hey, are you scared? It's like, don't be scared. He goes, my Jimmy can fly anything. You know, he could fly, if there was a washing machine to fly. She has such, you know, confidence in her son's ability that she derives that strength. Like she musters the strength to give to them, you know, strength. You know, when they were trying to hold, you know, try to keep it together and be strong so they could tell her the news, she flips the script on them and she's the rock. She's the one who tells them, don't be scared. You know, I believe in my son. Everything's going to be fine. I thought it was a great move.
Oh, absolutely. And it is, you know, like it everything did end up being fine. But again, like you're getting, not only are we, okay, we're past not landing on the moon. We're on the way home. They righted the trajectory of the LEM. They're headed towards Earth. That was a tense moment. And then another even tenser moment comes on the reentry.
Yeah. The thing here is that with the power that they've saved, they don't know if they have to turn everything back on from the you know, the service module and the lander, because that there are things that they need to turn on to land. There is releasing the components, everything that they've been sitting in has to be jettisoned. They have to, you know, activate guidance and parachutes and strap themselves in. So there's a whole bunch, and that's what Mattingly was on the ground trying to figure out, like sequencing how to turn everything on and squeeze enough power into the computer so they can manage to do any of this stuff. And this is, it's kind of heartbreaking too, because at that point it's like they let the lander go, that thing that's, you know, been their lifeboat. So that drifts off into space and is destroyed. They also get to see for the first time when they separate from the service module what exactly happened, and they see the extent of the damage, where a whole panel on the side of the whole thing and blown off. And it's kind of scary too. And it also justifies a lot of the concerns that they had. They're like, well, what if we turn around? Well, the bell housing of this engine might be damaged. And then they're like, yeah, you're right. If we did that, we would have exploded. You know, that puts all this stuff in perspective. And you know, it's the culmination of all these things where look how many things could have happened and how many things were avoided because everyone just kept a cool head and just made the right decisions and calculated the heck out of everything.
Yeah, this was like, I guess, best case scenario for failure in a certain regard, you know. And the tension that's created when there's that audio blackout is so palpable, you know, and you know they're gonna make it, but still, like, maybe something happens, right? Mission Command, everybody's chewing on their fingernails, like waiting to happen. The families are gathered around their big old TVs, you know, waiting to see what's going to happen. And then all of a sudden you hear, hello, Houston, this is the Odyssey. It's good to see you again, right? Yeah. How composed, no hooting and hollering. And I wonder if that was like the legitimate line that Jim Lovell said to Mission Control.
I think that he said something like a little bit more technical, like just like as far as like radio communication. Still, like, it hits hard. And seeing this movie, having seen this movie so many times and knowing what happens, you know, even with this rewatch and after that blackout, and you see the lander with the parachutes, and you hear that, and everyone sort of the relief wash over people. It's like, I still got kind of choked up.
Oh, same here. Absolutely. You know, and then it goes into Jim Lovell's speech at the end. You know, they land safely, and then they kind of do the where everybody ends up in the future, you know, and he uses a very interesting phrase in the movie where it's called a successful failure.
Right.
You know, like these guys managed to get home. Okay. And that's another thing that NASA does where, you know, it's never considered a failure. They're considered attempts at success.
That's a very positive outlook. It's like that ending is such a relief because we've been watching the tension. We've been with the astronauts, but we've been on the ground with the crew who are remote and distant, and their lives were in their hands. And when it comes to like in Ed Harris's character is refusing to even, you know, consider the odds, you know, people are like, the president wants an update. Like give him, like he wants to know what the odds are. They're going to come home. And Harris, like, they're coming home. Like, we're not even entertaining the idea that they're not, you know, right. Failure is not an option. And like you said, the composure, it's like, everyone is like cheering. And then he sort of at the end sort of slumps in the chair and he looks like he just sort of, you know, he fights back a tear and sort of just kind of like clears his throat and gets up. And he's like, yeah, okay. We, good job, guys. You know?
Yeah. He is basically saying like, these guys can't see me cry.
Essentially. Yeah. After I've yelled at them, I was NASA's dad this whole time. I can't be weak.
Yeah, exactly. He was NASA's dad. Also very interesting too. Like this is his second space movie. He played John Glenn in The Right Stuff.
That's another movie too. When we're talking about like timelessness and showing like that connection to things where it's like, I forget how old that movie is because it's again, like a really well-crafted movie about this particular period. And it does such a great job of showing the early days of like spaceflight and NASA. So he's great. And there's like that connecting thread of these movies sort of jumping off from that movie many, many years before Apollo 13. And this movie sort of picks up almost immediately after that.
Yeah. And also like this movie was nominated for so many Academy Awards, but not nominated for Best Director, which I think is kind of interesting. And it won for Best Film Editing and Best Sound. Yeah. It lost to Braveheart for Best Picture because what a wild time, huh?
Yeah, right. It's interesting to think about that stuff, you know, like people like personal opinions of the people since then aside. It's like that was a very I liked Braveheart, but if I were to sit here and tell you which one was the better movie now, I would have to choose Apollo 13 because I think it's just a better made movie. You know, I think Braveheart is a more exciting story, but I feel like this is such a technical achievement. I think it's very superior in that regard.
I'll agree with you. I would go with Apollo 13. There's so many interesting, like, I guess, losses where Ed Harris also was nominated for Best Supporting and lost to Kevin Spacey in Usual Suspects, which I find very interesting. I feel like the nod should have gone to Ed Harris.
Yeah.
Best Actress in Supporting Role, Kathleen Quinlan was nominated for her portrayal as Mrs. Lovell, but lost to Mira Sorvino in Mighty Aphrodite. That's tough to beat. Wild, man. Like to think like in 1 year you got Apollo 13 and Braveheart.
It's yeah. I mean, and we're also like, this is like you mentioned that this is hot on the heels of Forrest Gump, which is again like another amazing technical achievement and in movie making and another dramatic, impactful story. And then this is what Tom Hanks is his next project is this, and then he sort of spills out to a bunch of things. So they did produced a series of HBO documentaries, a dramatic series based on going to the moon, you know, from it being a fictional thing to the space race and all this other stuff.
Yeah, very interesting, I think, career trajectory for Forrest Gump, for Tom Hanks. He'll always be Forrest Gump to me. Yeah, like he's an interesting guy. And I think I don't think the movie would be as charming if it wasn't Tom Hanks as Jim Lovell.
Yeah, he holds it together. He's the one who's he keeps the crew in check. And I wanted to put this in the notes, but I didn't really know how to word it until right now. But I feel like Tom Hanks in this movie as Jim Lovell always knows the right things to say, you know, when it comes to talking to his superiors. You know, he has the words handy, or he's better than me because I can't figure out what to say right now. But like, he always knows how to say things and address the situation. If it's talking to his superiors, if it's talking to his crew, if it's sort of addressing things to his family, he is so calm and reasonable that it's hard to argue with what he's saying, and that he's the glue to the whole situation.
Do you think Tom Hanks is our best biopic actor?
You know, Tom Hanks there's so much adoration for him because he is so affable and charming, but you also feel so secure in what he's saying and doing by the way he portrays things, because it's mm-hmm. so genuine and also reassuring. So when he plays these roles, like, he is very much the person that we want in the situation. So if it's like in this movie, he is the level-headed astronaut who's going to calculate things. If he is I think there was like a recent movie where he's like a ship captain. He's like, I'm working the problem, I'm solving things, I'm just doing the procedure and keeping calm, because we have to get through this event. And he's excellent at doing that, you know. Mm-hmm. And he also looks like he's like a time traveler. He fits in whatever time period you put him in.
Oh yeah, yeah, 100%. So you got, let's see, Apollo 13, Saving Private Ryan. Fantastic. Absolutely. Definitely do Saving Private Ryan on this. I love that movie. We should just do a Tom Hanks deep dive, you know. But I think as he got older, you have him as Sully Sullenberger,
right?
Very interesting. Captain Phillips.
Mm-hmm.
You had him as Walt Disney in Saving Mr. Banks.
Yes.
And I think what's the other one that I'm thinking of?
Toy Story,
the life of Woody in Toy Story. And oh man, I can't believe I'm drawing a blank on the other movie that was on the Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, right, Mr. Rogers. Yeah,
yeah. So I think it's fascinating, like, just to, like you said, the timelessness of Tom Hanks really lends itself to these roles as a person, because he is so affable, charming, and likable.
No, I agree. And I, like I said, like, he's the glue to this crew. He's the glue to this movie. Everyone does an amazing job, but I can't see Apollo 13 being made with someone else. Originally, they sort of wanted Kevin Costner for the job because he bore some sort of resemblance to Jim Lovell. But, you know, what Tom Hanks brings to roles like this one, and Saving Private Ryan, is this passion for authenticity, because he is like a big NASA nerd. You know, he cares about these things, you know, and he brings that to the roles, because it's not just, I'm here for the day to do a job, I'm going to read this. And he wants to get everything right. He loves all of this stuff. He's been a fan of this, so he wants to make the most authentic portrayal possible. So, I mean, that's... what else can you say about, you know, about that?
Yeah. Yeah. What does it for you about this movie?
There's a particular line from this movie that sticks with me. It's when Ed Harris says, let's work the problem. And whenever I'm faced with something overwhelming or difficult, hearing him say that in my mind usually gives me like the clarity and perspective to get through it. I mean, if you think about it, this is as hopeless a scenario as it gets. It's three men adrift in outer freaking space in a very primitive spacefaring vessel that wasn't designed for versatility. And yet, where most people would fail or give up or lose it or just sort of collapse or freeze from the overwhelming nature of things, they just said, listen, let's work the problem. Let's start figuring out these little things and go along the way. You know, like, obviously, like, I'm no astronaut, and I haven't been faced with such a monumental situation, but you know, I've still faced overwhelming tasks, and going, you know, okay, let's work the problem has helped me get through it. You know, like anything that you encounter, just try it out. You know, you have a big project at work, work the problem. You get lost in the woods, it's like a survival thing, just work the problem. You know, just sitting here and think, you'd be surprised at how much you can accomplish if you just keep a cool head and start small and just think your way through things. So it, again, I mentioned this before, it's like, it's a testament to this movie that I forget it's a movie, even though it's based on real events. You know, how Ron Howard's attention to detail is legendary at this point, and his ability to accurately recreate events so authentically goes a long way to transport you into the story as if you were a fly on the wall. You know, who else is going to think about putting actors and building a set in a plane and flying parabolic arcs just to simulate that zero G environment? It's a fantastic movie, and it's a wonderful tribute to the people that were portrayed in it. So mad respect for this film.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, I love this movie, and I feel like we're a little bit like far removed. We're coming up on like the 30th anniversary of this movie. And I think it's one of those things that kind of escape people's purview. So if you're listening to this episode, I suggest to watch Apollo 13 if you haven't already. But I love this movie. I think this movie is, again, like, it does feel like you're almost watching a documentary at certain times, you know, like it's very well crafted and very well made. But I think, you know, the bottom line for me personally is that, you know, this is, as human beings, this is a testament to us being able to achieve anything we set our minds to. And if that goes wrong, this is a testament to how to solve our problems by figuring out how we got into a certain situation and then getting out of it, you know, like, so it's ultimately up to us collectively to do these great things and also be responsible for these great things, you know. And it's a very heavy movie in that way, but it's also, you know, it's a very human movie in that it stops being about landing on the moon and it becomes like, listen, we need to get these three guys home because guess what? We're all family. There's 50 of us in command center and we all have the same thoughts and actions. Like, we need to get these guys back because they're our boys, you know? So the movie works for me on like so many different levels. And, you know, you get like the stark reality of the, like a, when a failure happens in outer space, that's not in your control, to writing the situation and writing the craft, if you will, and then coming home and nailing the landing, and, you know, truly a happy ending. And I think it just makes it even more sweet that this actually happened.
You said something that's super interesting, and it's like, when given a faced in a situation like this, it sort of puts a lot of things into perspective, where something like this, there's this huge problem and we all have to get together and solve it. And it sort of strips away any of the things that are futile and unimportant. You know, it's like there's like one person in this movie that sort of has his personal stake on the line. And it's the guy who represents the manufacturers of one of the LEMs or something. And he's just kind of like, hey, listen, I just want you to know that whatever happens, we didn't design it to do that. And everyone's like, listen, chill out. Like, we're not worried about this. Don't worry about losing your job. You know, let's figure out the problem. And that's the only sort of admission of other people's, what's it called? Their interest and their self-interest and things like that. Because it's like, as you said, you know, this is a human achievement. This is, you know, we're all people. We're really good at problem solving. This is something that we all just needed to get together and take care of it. You know, the people who are on the ground are trying to solve it. The people who are watching it are emotionally invested because this is a significant thing. And, you know, it's almost like kind of heartbreaking where things like this, I'm glad that there aren't tragedies in space, don't get me wrong, but having something like NASA and science where people are just like, let's put our heads together and solve problems and explore. I wish that we could get to that point where these are the things that we're focusing on.
Amen, brother. Take us out, man. I couldn't have put it better myself.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Film Class Zeros. This is more of a documentary series of real events than talking about a movie. But, you know, that's how good Apollo 13, the movie is. So thanks again for joining us. And we will catch you on the flip side.
Later.